Hello, Craig.
We got NCAA tournament game, parentheses S,
yeah.
Parentheses, to talk about, to preview. And we have a team that is achieved already more than it's ever achieved before, but still has definitely one thing that has not achieved this year or any year. And so I'm excited to talk about that. But first, this is Podcast Versus Everyone, episode 182. I'm Craig Powers. With me is Jeff Neusser, and we'll talk about the annoying as fuck men's NIT loss in a bit. But first, we're going to start with the NCAA tournament, the women, this Saturday, hopefully starting an NCAA tournament run against Florida Gulf Coast. And Jeff, like, it was kind of a bittersweet, I guess, a bit, Selection Sunday, because they got in, obviously, we knew that was going to happen. They got the highest seed they've ever gotten, a 5 seed, which was, I think, an indication that the committee definitely took into factored in Charlize Leisure-Walker's absences in 4 of their losses. Not quite the 4 seed that maybe they could have achieved if she actually played in those games, but definitely higher than their net ranking would indicate. So a 5 seed, obviously getting rewarded a bit for winning the Pac-12 championship. Very cool stuff. They were very excited. It was very cool to see the video. So just that was great. The one thing that was a bummer is, as we know, 50% of the regional final and regional semifinals are in Seattle, but the Cougs feed into the Greenville, South Carolina bracket, which is just a bit of a bummer. You thought that maybe a 5 seed would earn the right to feed into the half of the bracket that is closer to their home, but that obviously didn't work out. I'm guessing WSU was maybe the last 5 seed, especially when you look at some of the teams that are in their little quadrant. But yeah, Jeff. Overall, what are your thoughts? What were your thoughts on Sunday? What have your thoughts been about the women and the draw they have gotten?
Yeah, I mean, same thoughts as you, mostly. Like, was just hoping for something maybe a little more favorable. I know we're going to dig into Florida Gulf Coast here before too long. And, they certainly seem dangerous, a super dangerous 12 seed, team that's won 30 games and maybe a little bit of an unknown in the sense that they haven't played many quality opponents, so it's kind of tough to know how good they might actually be. But there's that piece, and like you said, heading all the way across the country to the East Coast, going to Villanova. If they'd been a 4, they'd be hosting, which would be incredible. I don't know if they would have done it in Pullman or if they would have done it in Spokane. I tend to think they probably would have done it in Spokane. Just to, get the attendance up a little bit more, but regardless, that's neither here nor there. So now they got to fly all the way to the East Coast. At least it's been spring break all week. So, maybe they haven't had to deal with classes or whatever, but, playing an East Coast team on the East Coast just kind of feels feels a little unfair. Right. As you mentioned, the pod, feeding into another East Coast regional site is just, it's a little, I don't know, man. It feels like, and maybe this is it, maybe they decided, hey, we'll throw you a bone with the 5 seed, but you have to travel, like maybe they were sort of stuck in between giving them a 5 and giving them a 6, and you know, maybe they sort of split the difference, you know, by having them play there. So, I mean, I can't be too mad. You know, 5-12 is great. You know, 5-12 is always, you know, ripe for upsets, as everybody knows in the men's tournament. But still, it's, you know, it's much better than the last couple of years where, you know, they were going in as, you know, maybe not underdogs, but certainly, you know, not prohibitive favorites. On this one, I've actually had a hard time finding betting lines on this, and I don't know why it's so hard to find that, but
yeah,
but
I seems like anyone would find one.
I don't know if anybody else knows of one. Let me know, or leave a comment on the site when you listen to this. But yeah, I haven't been able to find a line. I was really curious what the betting markets were saying about you know, how much the Cougars would be favored by, but haven't found that yet. So I mean, all things considered, I'm, you know, I'm thrilled with the seed. Just in terms of just the number, that's fantastic. And then, you know, the other thing is this, like, yes, they will have to play on the road, but they're also not, you know, they avoided what we've been talking about the whole time, which is not being a 7, 8, 9, or 10 where you're feeding into one of those teams. And I think the ones and the twos outside of South Carolina are maybe a bit weaker this year than they have been, but still, you know, The top 6 to 8 teams in women's basketball are stronger relative to the rest of the field than they are in men's. The talent tends to be a little more concentrated at the top. So I'm thrilled that, you know, if they make it to the second round, you know, you got a 4 seed, you're going to play on the road, but you will have been there for a couple of days already, and this team has shown it can play on the road. So I guess that's a lot of words, like we do on the podcast, a lot of words to say that I'm pretty happy, Craig. Pretty happy.
Yeah, it's interesting that the obviously they won't come west. You know, obviously, even if they get to the Final Four, it's in Texas. So the bummer is that they would have drawn, like, if they were even you know, California or Arizona or Colorado, wherever, you know, wherever the, you know, if they were on a West Coast thing, which, you know, they wouldn't have been because they're not going to put them in a pod with, you know, UCLA or Stanford or whatever. But you know, if they would have maybe had maybe something closer, I think more Coug fans would have went. Now, you know, hopefully they can get a good contingent of Coug fans that, there are quite a few out east. You know, when I went to the CBI, there was a nice contingent there that went to Pittsburgh, and a lot of them were from like DC, New York, and Philly areas. So those are pretty easy trips to get to the Philadelphia. If and plus, you know, having the first game on Saturday, a little bit easier for people that live in the area to get there, and so that's nice. Now 11:30 in the morning, or I guess it's 2:30 there, 11:30 for us. But, you know, that's better than, people might recall, last year when they played, it was at 8 o'clock in the morning Pacific time for the first round game. And definitely, you know, I think a big point you said, like, South Carolina, if they could somehow get, you know, if they could get past out of this Villanova, pod, yeah, you're playing probably a one, but you're not in South Carolina's quadrant, so that's a good sign. You know, just the fact that you could, like, because I don't know if anyone could be even come close to them this year, but yeah. And in terms of the teams they are playing, let's look at Florida Gulf Coast. You mentioned they have 30 wins, which is, you know, a bit scary. You know, a team that just hasn't lost very much, and honestly, they rolled through. I think they had one loss early in the Atlantic Sun, but they rolled through the Atlantic Sun. If you look at the scores, they won every game by, let me get them up, game.
I can tell you that their margin of victory, or sorry, their margin per game, which includes their 3 losses, two of which were by like 20 points to Stanford.
Yeah, to Duke and Stanford.
And to Duke, right. Even with that, their overall margin per game was plus 20.2.
Yeah. So
that's
like
that's pretty good.
They really haven't been. So they lost to Liberty in overtime on January 21st. And since then, the closest game was beating Stetson on the road by 10. You have a lot of 40, 50-point win in there, several 40-point wins. They really have not been tested. You know, in Liberty, when they played them in the conference tournament, they came back and destroyed them by 24. You know, they typically score, they typically shoot well, although their shooting dipped a bit, against Austin Peay, but they typically shoot really well. They shoot a lot of threes. We were talking about they are a Maury Ball, you know, the Houston general manager, a Maury Ball team. They shoot threes and layups. Nearly half of their shots are threes. So let's look at the percentage in a 3-point rate. Where's that on this for hoop stats? It's always like a little hard to find things sometimes. They were first in the country. 47% of their shots are 3-pointers. They have it as their free throw rate is 19%, and that's 64th. I don't know if that seems really low to be 64th. Maybe in women's they just don't shoot nearly as many free throws. Could be a case, or one of those things on her hoop stats that kind of reverse stuff.
Yeah, I kind of think maybe I'd lean for
it. I'm thinking maybe that's one of the ones reverse, because like their free throw rate for opponents is 13%, and that's 30th. So I'm thinking they just make it like the low number is better on both sides. So they're probably it would make more sense that they don't get to the line because they shoot a ton of threes. Half their shots threes, the rest are layups. They're threes and layups all the way. And they play five guards like they almost all the time. Their sixth man is a 6-foot forward. But they've for the most part played guards. Their best player is 5'3" guard.
I was gonna say the forward, by the way, shoots threes on 46% of her shots.
So. Mm-hmm.
like it does not matter who's on the floor. They're shooting.
Yep. And they have a lot of good shooters. You know that their top scorer is Tishara Morehouse, and she is 5'3", so not big. Definitely, WSU's guards are going to have a significant size advantage on her. But she does shoot 40% from three and shoots 5 a game, so she's a prolific and productive 3-point shooter. She is one of the ones that actually does get in the lane a little bit more. Because she does shoot more than half of her shots, you know, 6.5 twos a game versus 5.5 threes. So she does a little bit more get in the lane, which I would assume, you know, and she's quite a good assist person. So I think, you know, I haven't watched much film, but I'm guessing she is she gets in the lane and she'll be a tough guard. You'll probably see Yo and Charlize check her, maybe Grace get a few minutes in there to check her a bit, because she's running their offense. And then they also have one other guard, Emma List. She also has a pretty high assist rate. So between those two, I think they're going to be handling the ball predominantly, and everyone's going to be shooting threes. Now WSU does a pretty solid job at limiting threes. That's part of their defensive philosophy. They were 92nd in 3-point rate allowed this year, so 26%. So, you know, that I anticipate that they are definitely going to try to force Florida Gulf Coast off the line, as they are so desperate to do that. But I am sure every team has tried to force Florida Gulf Coast off the line, at least if any team with a decent coach.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously what Florida Gulf Coast wants to do. They have a ton of really good shooters. So they just generally very good offense, very high percentages, some of the highest shooting percentages in the country. But one thing you always have to kind of, they're seventh in field goal percentage overall. They don't have effective field goal percentage on here, I don't think. But I would guess their effective field goal percentage is close to the top, given how many three-pointers they shoot and how well they shoot. They're 38% from three, which is seventh nationally, 58% on the twos they take. They're very efficient because they only take easy twos. They do not take mid-range shots. But as I said, they've played a very, very weak schedule. They played Stanford and Duke and did not play particularly well against them. Of course, neither WSU didn't play well against Stanford either. But I'm guessing when it comes to WSU's defense here, I think their height is going to help. I think that's going to be a key offensively too.
I was going to say, let me throw something out at you here. You're talking about their height. Like, normally we think of height helping on the interior, right? I think that where the height makes a difference here is what we saw, last year with our men's basketball team, which didn't have a lot of height, right, on the perimeter, and it made it difficult to shoot, right? They'd get guarded by longer teams. It's harder to get shots off. So here's a couple to throw at you. In the game against Stanford, they put up 46. I am not making that up. 46 threes out of their 70 shots. Okay. So they had 70 shots, so 24 twos and 46 threes, and they only made 13 of them. Okay, so they made 13, so 28% of their threes in that game. And then against Duke, they took 20 threes in that one, but also only made 5. So it's kind of a, maybe there's a little something there, but they've had other games too that were quite bad as well. Like I'm looking. The game after Stanford, they shot 27% against Hawaii on 37 attempts. The game after that, they shot 29% on threes on 24 attempts. The game after that against something called Ave Maria, shot 14 of 48, 29%. The game after Duke against Kentucky, which was a game that they won, they only shot 32% and only 25 of their 55 field goal attempts in that one were threes, and their free throws, they shot 19 free throws. So, I don't know, man. There's a little bit of an indicator here that maybe they'll kind of take what you give them to some extent. Like, they would prefer to shoot the threes, but if you're maybe going a little too hard on the threes, like perhaps Kentucky was, maybe they sense an opportunity there to get into the lane. I mean, they have another... I don't know. I mean, some of these other games where they have, like Mercer, they had 25 free throw attempts. I mean, I don't know how much you read into that because it's Mercer. But, the fact they had 19 free throw attempts against Kentucky perhaps is, I don't know, maybe noteworthy. Maybe they have a counter for teams that want to try and run them off the line.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's, like we said, it's just hard to read because they're just so far and above their competition in their conference. So it's just like, it's hard to read into a lot of their results because it's like, well, they obviously have much better players and a much better maybe coach system, whatever. You just don't see teams run through their conference with that level of dominance. Like to have one close game in the entire conference schedule, 20 plus conference games, would you include the tournament? That's insane.
Not even Gonzaga does that.
Yeah.
Like even Gonzaga at their very best didn't do that. So
yeah, that's like when Belmont was in the ASUN before they moved up, they were crushing teams in the men's area. You see this sometimes in these one bid leagues. Make no mistake, like they have shooters. Like you cannot shoot, they have these many players that shoot 40+% and have them not be good. Like even if you're getting open looks, like you got to be good to hit 40+%. So that's the big key. They're going to shoot threes. You just got to make sure they're contested. There's got to be a hand in their face because these are good shooters and there's good shooters. There's going to be five good shooters on the floor at all times, pretty much. Like, so it's just, they're just going to really have to focus on getting that contesting. They're going to have to focus on closeouts it's going to be interesting, you know, because, I think they have the personnel to do that. You know, Charlize and Yo are very good, on-ball defenders. You could bring in Grace off the bench, very good all-ball defender. Of course, like, her offense is a little limiting, and then you have, Bella is quick enough. You know, Bella is quick enough that she could still kind of hang. Now, when Jess Clark comes in, and I think she could beat them up on offense, but the defense may be a little bit tough for her, because it's just so many guards on the floor. She's going to have to guard a guard. That's why I do think you might see a little bit more Grace in this one because of so many guards. And then you have Tara, who guards all the time. Like, she uses her length very well. She's quick for her height, and she's length. Ula, you know, that's an iffy one. We might see more Tahina in this one than Ula, just because Ula may not match up that well with them. But we'll see, you know. And there could be enough of a offensive advantage to having that size, especially on the glass, that they may ride with their same lineup, because Ula and Tara and Charlize and Bella are going to dominate the glass against this team. They don't rebound offensively that well, and I think it's largely because of their height. And you're thinking of, they're probably not that much shorter than a lot of the teams they play in the A-Sun, but against a team like WSU that's going to be taller than them at probably four positions at least. I think WSU, which at times have struggled on the offensive glass, but largely is, defensive glass, but largely has been, they've been able to lock it down when they need to. That's gotta be a focus here. There's gonna be misses because they're shooting threes. Like, there's gonna be more misses. So you gotta be ready to clean that glass, not give them any second opportunities. And honestly, like, they're just not that good at getting them. So, because that's where you're going to be at the risk of giving up those wide open threes on those rebounds. So if WSU's rolling with a bigger lineup, that's going to be their advantage. Now, if we switch to when WSU has the ball, I always love to see this. I always think it's a sign of a good coach. So I think Florida Gulf Coast probably has a good coach. Is that they do the same things defensively. They limit the same things defensively that they try to achieve offensively. And Jeff and I talk about that all the time.
Yep.
And that's why we will praise Kyle Smith quite a bit, because, you know, WSU, the men's team, shoots threes a lot, and they limit threes. Like, that's kind of the two fundamental aspects of both ends of the floor for them. And Florida Gulf Coast is the same way. They're an extreme. They, to an extreme, limit three-point attempts. Now, I think if you were looking at the last 2 years, WSU teams, this would have been a much bigger issue than it is this year. WSU was a much more prolific three-point shooting team. They were shooting a lot more threes last year than they did this year. With the emergence of Bella inside, and with Tahina's ability to get to the lane, along with Charlize, who has, I think, improved her shooting, which has been enabled her to get into the lane more. With Tara's emergence as a mid-range to low-post scorer, the Cougs have been able to get easier twos than they have in the past. So we're seeing them go inside for buckets more. And this is a game where Bella could eat inside. Like, the tallest player on Florida Gulf Coast is 6 foot. Bella's 6'3" with a wingspan of someone who's like 6'7". Like, she's with the way she's developed her post game, like, I'm excited for her offensively. Now, hopefully defensively, the guards don't her the other way. I think she's quick enough to be, she'll be okay. But I offensively could see Bella being a huge key to WC's success in this game.
Yeah, and if we look back to these these two games, right? Because not that WSU is as good as Stanford at all, but the Cougs are a lot more like Stanford than they are like most of the teams that Florida Gulf Coast played in their league, right? Like, does that make sense? That like,
absolutely,
we're closer to Stanford than to that, right? Stylistically, personnel wise, things like that. Haley Jones, who, you know, I don't know that we have totally an analog for her, but you know, Charlize might be
no one does.
Like that to some degree, exactly. She was 12 of 17 on twos and also had 14 rebounds. Cameron Brink didn't actually have a huge game. She only played 16 minutes, but in those 16 minutes, she had 13 points and 7 rebounds, right? So, you know, again, that was a game where it seemed like Stanford was really able to use their height and athleticism to you know, affect the game there. And then as I'm looking at the Duke game, I'm not as familiar with Duke's personnel, and it doesn't list their heights or anything like that. But as I'm looking at, you know, the rebounds in that game, Duke had 11 offensive rebounds. I'm doing this on the fly here. Florida Gulf Coast had 14 defensive rebounds. So there, that's, I don't know, 40-something percent, right? On that one. So yeah, it's, you know, I do think that 44%, sorry, I was like doing the math in my head there. So I just think like there are indicators here of the height maybe, you know, being a factor, and Bella particularly being able to kind of do what she does. And I think that like one of the most, I think, remarkable things about her development this year is that she's learned to play so much more under control. Like she would get the ball and in the past, and it seemed like sometimes she would hurry, or she was, you know, I don't want to say afraid. Like she wasn't afraid someone was coming, but she was like, oh my God, I got the ball. I got to do something with it. Right. And this year her composure is just so much stronger. She's so much better at recognizing when she has an advantage. She also used to force shots a lot. Doesn't really do that nearly as much anymore. Doesn't fade away from the basket nearly as much as she used to on those on jump hooks and things like that. I mean, even in the past, like smaller, stronger players would really sometimes really bother her because they'd kind of get under her legs and they'd push her away from the basket. And she's really improved her strength like a ton, and she just doesn't get flustered. I think she's become a better passer. She just, I think, is just a much more savvy, much more mature, much more composed player. And I don't, you know, in the past, I might have thought a game like this where it's like, okay, Bella seems to have an obvious advantage. Maybe, you know, it might have been tougher going. I mean, I know we're going to talk about the NIT game, but like, you know, Eastern clearly wanted to take advantage of the fact that we didn't have a big man. And that was actually problematic for them, right? They kept trying to force it in and it wasn't going great. In this one, I feel like, you know, same thing. If, you know, if it's there for Bella, she really is going to, as you said, eat. You know, but if it's not, I think she's composed enough to, you know, just kind of take what's there and find her teammates when, you know, when maybe the other team's overplaying her.
Yeah, Bella's passing out of doubles has become really good. Like she's, and passing from the high post, she's just really improved. And, like, so I, yeah, she can, yeah, she's just, the amount she's improved, like you said. Charlize and then Tahina as well have a variety of mid-range shots. You know, Charlize has got floaters, Charlize has got pull-ups. And if that's what they're going to give us, Charlize can hit those shots. And she's very proficient at hitting 15-footer. She likes that shot a lot. Yeah. So, you know, if they're going to give us that, like, Charlize could go 2 points, 2 points all day. You know, Tahita's very good in the mid range, and Tara's very good in the mid range. You know, I could see Charlize maybe not, you know, having the same game that she had against UCLA where she made a bunch of threes. It's more of a game that she is actually more typical for, is where she's getting inside and just kind of beating – beating her defender off the dribble, which is she's so good at. And I could see her having that game. I don't, you know, this could be a game where, Tadair's going to really have to, use her, shot fake and her quick first step to get into the lane, because a lot of teams have been selling out to deny her threes. And a team like this, I know is going to be doing that, you know, yeah. Because that's what they do to everyone. So I think it's just going to be, and what's going to be important, for the Cougs, in doing that is take care of the ball. And, Florida Gulf Coast pretty solid at forcing turnovers, 22% turnover rate by their opponents. And they don't turn the ball over typically that much, which is indicative of a team that shoots a ton of threes. They're not taking, but it's so, yeah, they're going to take their take care of the ball, because I think they're going to be dribbling a lot. We know they could kind of get in these sequences where they get, you know, stack three or four turnovers, and you don't want to do that against a team that can hit threes. Suddenly you find yourself behind on a run, especially if they're live ball turnovers.
FGCU does thrive on those live ball turnovers. They are a team that steals the ball. They're going to overplay. They're going to try and take it away. And I would guess, you know, since their coaching staff seems very smart, I would guess those feed into a lot of transition threes, would be my guess. Those that are analytically minded know that a transition three is actually a really good 3-point shot. It seems a little counterintuitive, you know, in that it maybe seems a little rushed, you know, and of course there are endless announcers who will say like, oh, you didn't need that shot that early in the shot clock. Not true. A transition three is actually a really good shot if it's wide open.
It's usually very open, very in rhythm, very comfortable to shoot.
It's one of the best in terms of like types of threes. Let me think about how to say this. The percentage that people make by type of three, that's like, I think, second highest. I think the highest is something like, I think offensive rebound and kick out, I think, is the highest. But I think transition threes are the second highest. So I would guess that they, you know, they try to take the ball away a lot. They do force a lot of turnovers. They've got two or three different players who average over two steals a game. That's actually a lot. they are going to pressure the ball. And as you mentioned, you know, we can be prone to spates of turnover-ness, you know. So they're going to have to be very good, I think, about taking care of the ball here and not, you know, and when a team can hit threes, I mean, the other thing is this too, you know, if we get out to a lead and all of a sudden make a few turnovers, they hit a few threes, we saw with the men, you know, like the men for the last two games of the year, both losses, but, you know, you can get back in a game in a hurry, you know, hitting a few threes. So, yeah, I think all of those things are things that, you know, that I'm sure Cammy's been drilling into their brains all week.
Something that's very interesting, given, and it might be you've been looking at the game, so I don't know if it's different based on their opponents. Maybe it's just because they're not undersized against their conference opponents, but their defensive rebounding rate is solid. They're at 72%. It's 68th nationally. That's a good defensive rebounding rate. That's a good place to be, especially when your tallest player is 6 foot. So my guess is they make it a point of emphasis. I'm guessing we'll see lots of like heavy box outs and stuff, to kind of push some of the taller players out of the key. So that'll be interesting because I could see someone like Tara. I don't think we're going to want to, you know, it's not really in our nature to crash the offensive glass, but if you could, you know, send one or two, so, just not a guard, but send someone like Tara, who's got the height and she's a solid offensive rebounder. I could see her racking up some offensive rebounds, or if Ula's in, using her size.
Ula's
to get
really
in there.
Good at that.
Yeah,
she's really good at just getting her hands on balls and kind of sneaking in and getting in a spot where she can grab an offensive rebound. To me, like I think it is curious. I think Ula could go kind of either way. Like this could be you know, a game where she plays a ton or a game where she doesn't play a lot. I think it kind of depends on how things are going. But so I guess maybe that sort of makes her the definition of an X factor. But I think she could be like, you know, maybe not the star of the game, but by the end of the game, say, yeah, she was our most important player. Cause you know, she's not real tall, obviously, but she's, you know, clearly a forward and, you know, just does a lot of the, you know, the things that, that help you win. I mean, I hate being cliche like that, but it's very true. And in this kind of a game, you know, she can be a versatile defender, also a really good rebounder. And then if they decide that they're just going to crash the offensive glass with abandon, she's the kind of person that could, that, you know, can make a real difference in there when she's sort of purposing to go get rebounds. I think we saw that a lot last year, you know, when we, they were, you know, the cardiac Cougs, right? And they'd come back and come back and come back in the fourth quarter. And it's like, okay, well now we're crashing the glass cause we're trying to come back. And it just seemed like she had a real knack for getting her hands on balls and getting, you know, securing offensive rebounds. So, if I was going to pick someone that I think could be like a surprise, like difference maker in the game, she would be my pick.
Yeah, that's a good pick because yeah, I agree. Like it could go either way there. You know, she has size, like, you know, she's 6 foot, so she's going to be as tall as everyone. She's obviously, she's stronger usually than most other 6 foot players she comes up against. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, we talked about the draw and stuff and this is a tough 12 seed. Like they're 36th in net. I have no idea how her hoop stats does their rankings. That's where we're getting a lot of our tempo free stats here. But they have, I think, they have them, I think, at 14. 15. So 15.
But yeah, close enough.
But yeah, so this team by, you know, some rating systems is very highly ranked and ranked well above a 12 seed. It makes you wonder where the committee got the 12 seed from.
I think it's, you know, just as simple as they haven't beaten anybody.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's how we got into the tournament 2 years ago with a fairly middling record was we proved we could beat some people, you know, and the committee really, really likes to see you beat people. And Florida Gulf Coast hasn't beaten like anybody. They beat Kentucky, and Kentucky's net, I think, was 90 or something. Like,
yeah.
60.
Yeah.
Maybe like 60. But anyway, it was, you know, not like the kinds of teams that, you know, we played, you know, week in and week out in the Pac-12. So I think that's where it comes from. You know, they seem to do less of the eye test than the men do, which can be, you know, both good and bad, right? Like, you know, the men's committee will be like, oh yeah, I've seen them play. They look like this. And so they, you know, adjust seating accordingly. The women, and you know, I'm sure it has as much to do with, you know, lack of exposure as anything else, but they seem to really rely on, you know, did you beat anybody who was any good? How many of them did you beat and where did you beat them? And, you know, kind of use that accordingly. So
Kentucky's number
this
80,
is a scary team. 80.
Yeah, they're definitely,
I knew it was something like that.
They're a scary team. They seem to be well coached. They play a style that is, you know, WSU doesn't really see very often. Or at all. So it's, you know, that, you know, playing with five guards on the floor, they're going to start five guards. You know, they may change it up because they're playing a taller team, but their forward, has only started one game, and I doubt this will be your second. You know, like, I don't see that happening.
Nope.
So, yeah, it's going to be, it's a scary matchup. You know, I would have hoped if WSU was a 5 seed, the 12 seed looked, you know, like it didn't look like such a challenge like this, because this to me it feels like a toss up game. Like you know, it's hard to get a gauge on how good Florida Gulf Coast is, but when you have that many players that can fill it up, like we're a good defense. What gives me hope, and I said this in our Slack chat, is that WSU just shut down one of the best offenses in the country in the Pac-12 tournament in Utah. And Utah's not stylistically exactly the same, but Utah has a bunch of shooters. They fill it up. They try to get out and run on live ball turnovers, similar. And they shut them down. And so maybe this defense is cooking right now, because they really have been, for especially in that Pac-12 tournament. And if they're in a good place defensively, they could shut, you know, Florida Gulf Coast down. And if they can force them into tough shots and force them into a low 3-point percentage, sub 30%, that'll be a good sign. And so, I'm looking forward to it. It should be a fun game. You know, it definitely feels more like a second round matchup than a first. It'll be a tough team. It'll be an exciting game, especially, you know, when you go to the tournament, you see those weird one bid conference schools, and this is one of them. Now, if WSU does beat Florida Gulf Coast, most likely, like probably 90%, they will play Villanova on their home floor. And the biggest thing you got to know about Villanova is that they have the leading scorer in the country in Maddie Segrist. I don't know if I said her name right. But she is a 6'1 forward who is both an inside outside player. She takes a primarily inside player. She takes 17 twos a game. 17 two-pointers a game, along with four threes. Yeah. Like, and she makes 55%
her usage,
of
by the way, her usage is 37.6%.
That's Caitlin Clark usage. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm trying, like, for our listeners to try
for a forward to have that is, that's like,
yeah. And, well, because it's
like
harder 80s, for forwards
that's
to
like
have
80s
that.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's like harder for forwards to have that because it's harder to get them the ball, right? So, yeah, so I'm sure they get her the ball in all sorts of creative ways, but, like, I don't know, what was Clay's usage like at his peak? Like
32, 33%? 32,
right?
I think, yeah, 32. Something like that. Same as Brock Modem.
So, yeah, so 37.6% is absolutely bonkers. She doesn't shoot a lot of threes, it's mostly the twos. 64% of her points come on twos.
But she does shoot four threes a game. So she does.
Yeah.
And she does shoot 37% on them. So, like, and she shoots 85% from the line, so you can't fucking foul her. She's a good.
And, oh, by the way, I was going to say, she offensive rebounds and she defensive rebounds.
Yep.
And her turnover percentage is 5%.
5%.
That's like. I don't know how to contextualize for people how low that number is.
A 37% usage player to only have a 5% turnover rate. That means almost all of her usage is a shot.
Almost. Almost.
That's why her offensive rating for a 37% usage player is, let me see, I find it again, 126.2.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's unbelievable. That's unbelievably efficient. So
that's like Caitlin Clark level efficiency. Like it's she's really good.
Yeah.
She's really good.
Yeah.
She's going to score points.
29 points a game.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy. They only have one other player in double figures.
Yeah. She's good. They are obviously a good offense when 37% of your possessions end in that person. They're a good offense.
Yes.
Yeah. So defensively, they're pretty solid as well. Pretty good limiting field goals. Field goal percentage, their 3-point rate also low. They also chase teams off the line. They're not quite as aggressive at shooting threes. Obviously when you have this insanely good interior player, why would you do that? This is Villanova is a team that could have easily been a 3 seed and they're a 4 seed. So WC's played a 12 seed that could easily have been a 9 seed or an 8 seed. And they're playing a 4 seed that probably could have been a 3 seed too. Villanova is really good. One of my very good friends, Catherine, went to Villanova, so I texted her right away. You probably met her in Mexico.
I remember.
So yeah, I texted her right away. You know, we might play each other in the second round. Villanova's tough. But WC's beaten teams as good as Villanova this year.
Yep.
They've beaten teams on the road as good as Villanova. They've beaten teams on neutral sites, whatever. WC has been, it's hard to get too much into Villanova because they don't know if they're going to play him or not. But, I think covering Maddie Segrist is important. She's just, you're going to hear her name a lot. if WC yep. gets to Monday. This is a tough pod. Like, in summation, this is a tough pod. You know, these are two.
Well, and I bet those other teams are looking at WSU the same way. Like,
yeah.
I bet Villanova's going like, damn. Like that's our five seed.
They just won the Pac-12 tournament.
Yep.
They're probably like, how did they lose 10 games? They lost 9 games of conference play and just ran through. We have Charlize Leger-Walker, we have Cammie Etheridge.
Yes, we do.
Those two factors just always make me feel good about WC women in any game they play. I think, you know, they have a tough road here, but, you know, in the last month, they've beat, you know, in the last just couple weeks, they've beaten a 4 seed on the road. They've beaten a 2 seed on neutral site. They've beaten a 5 seed on neutral site. They've beaten a 4 seed again on neutral site. They've beaten tournament quality teams on the road. The teams as good as Villanova and as good as FTCU on the road and on neutral sites repeatedly. Like, unlike any WSU team I've ever seen. Like, they've been so, so good on the road. Like, I'm not too worried about them being away from home with this. Like, I'm not sure if it's a big factor. Like, it might not be. Like, for them, like, it might be better for them to be on the road, honestly. They love their having their back against the wall, their chip on the shoulder. Like, they love that. So I'm really looking forward to this. You and I are so excited. We are gonna show up to the Sounders game late to watch this game.
Yep.
Shout out Flatstick Pub for gonna have the game on Saturday. So if you're around a Flatstick Pub, if you want to watch the WSU women, we know that all the Flatstick locations will have them on Saturday.
Yep.
We got Jeff messaged our guy Rob and got that confirmation. So. It's not always a guarantee that you're getting the women's sports on TV in a bar, unless you like know the people that work there and can make them change it. But yeah, it's exciting. You know, the ESPNU on Saturday, I am assuming it'll be on ESPN2 or ESPN on the next game, but, so you might have to go to a bar to watch it because a lot of people don't get ESPNU. So Plastic Pub. I'm really looking forward to it. This is just the best, you know, this version of this, team is the best one we've seen in the last 3 years, by far. They've already done such amazing things this year, and it would just be so, so great to see them on Saturday get that first, NCAA tournament win in program history. Like, it would be, I will be crying in Flatstick if that happens. So, I believe that they could do it. Florida Gulf Coast is tough, but honestly, this team is the toughest fucking team I've ever seen. And they have smart coaches and smart players, veteran players, and they'll know what to do. And so they'll be prepared, I should say, as prepared as you can be. So, I'm looking forward to it. yeah, so check it out, 11:30 a.m. ESPNU Saturday. And, yeah, it'll be exciting. Jeff, do you have any other thoughts, or should we move on to our beer talk here?
Yeah, let's move on to beer talk.
Talk about beer. Yeah.
I know. We need a song for the beer talk.
I just stole that from Gregor on 107.7. His nerd talk thing. We do now because we're like, fuck the sponsors. We don't care. Like, they're not going to be paying us anymore anyway. Like, no more breaks. See, I finally learned, Jeff. No more breaks.
Thank you. Yeah.
It does make me sad that we don't get to use, Randy England's lovely, intro, outro music from breaks.
That's true. A bummer. I could just throw it in there just for fun.
Just like, let's talk.
Let's
talk over it a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff.
Randomly drop in the little 10-second bumper.
I know what you're drinking, but.
You do.
Anyways, tell me what you're drinking.
Because you gave it to me. I am having a Pliny the Elder from Russian River Brewing. Russian River Brewing.
Wesson Weber Bowie.
Yeah. Which is actually the second time that I've had this in like a week and a half, which is great.
Woo!
The last time I had it, I was in Portland and had a little bit of it at the bar that we went to. I think I talked about that on last week's show. And then, I brought you some beer back from Portland, and you were like, take a Pliny. And I was like, if you insist. And actually, I had driven down the road, right? I hadn't gotten the text message, and I saw it and I'm like, okay, I guess I can come back. So came back and grabbed a Pliny. So yeah, this is OG IPA and
OG double
still delicious.
IPA.
Yeah. Absolutely still delicious. And thank you very much for letting me drink it.
Yeah, it's one of like Pliny and Hetty have these Hetty toppers. So you brought me some Hetty topper
and some Hetty topper.
Pliny the Elder and Hetty Topper have this like same status where they're just, despite being around for so long, especially in their packaged versions, they're just like still really hard to get. Like they go really fast. But we are so I thought it's a fun like trade, if you will, to like, you brought me some Pliny and Focal Banger, and then I gave you Russian River's version of you brought me some Hetty and Focal Banger. And I gave you some Pliny and Blind Pig. And those are like...
Yes.
Those are like two beer... Like, Focal Banger is basically Alchemist's Blind Pig. You know? Like, so it's a perfect trade. Like, a perfect trade of beer there. And pretty cool that Hetty Topper is showing up in Portland. It shows up every few months. And lucky you got down there to have some. I think you had the Focal Banger at a bar, right? Like it too.
Yes, I had the Focal Banger at a bar. They didn't have they didn't have any Hetty. And then I was like looking on Untappd, and they were like, this guy called this place called Growler Guys supposedly has some Hetty. And I'm like, okay. So on our way out of town, I stopped by, and sure enough, they've got like this cooler, you know, full of beers, and there it is. They've got like, I don't know, half a dozen Hetties and half a dozen Focal Bangers in there. And I'm like, cool, I'll grab a couple and bring them back. And I grabbed a couple other ones, whatever. Dude, Craig, they were $6. And I was like, I just paid whatever it was at the bar. It was $10. I know you're paying a bar premium at the bar. It was $10. But still, it's like, you know, I mean, I pay $5, $6 for, I mean, I don't
IPAs
know. Like,
just
like IPAs all the time when I'm at Rainier Growlers. Like, you know, just, and not like, you know, like Single Hill stuff, right? Which is really good, but also is not like, you know, whatever. So yeah, they didn't have them priced obviously in the fridge. So I was like, I didn't really know. And I was like, okay, well, I'll grab a couple. And now I'm like, and then I got the bill, you know, of course, no tax. And I'm like, God damn, I should have gotten like three or four more of those. But
yeah,
I'll get
there is, there
time.
Is always like, I always feel bad about like taking it all, like not letting the next person get some.
I was not trying to take it all. But I might have taken like a couple more.
Yeah.
You know?
Of course. So. But Pliny the Elder, I am also drinking. I thought it'd be cool if we drank the same beer. The last time we drank the same beer, I think, was, well, when we were remote, was Heady Topper. So, but Pliny, I'm so excited because I bought this in bottles a block and a half from me. And we've mentioned it before. I think Russian River is back in Washington State. So exciting. One of the, just the all-time great breweries in the history of the world. All-time most influential breweries in American craft brewing. Just like, and they pulled out of Washington for 10 years because we just had this really shitty distribution system. But since then, there's been popped up a lot of independent distributors. They're working with Stoop to distribute their beer so they have more control about where the beer goes. That's why they left. You know, their beer was getting sent to these random liquor stores and it was just sitting on shelves and like Pliny was going bad or whatever. They didn't like that. So now they have more control because they go to places where Stoop goes. So that's, you know, that's usually finer places, you know, places where people buy craft beer. Plus there's more of an appetite for IPAs and stuff than there were 10 years ago. Very exciting. You know, I bought this from Beer Star, and you know, I think it's the first, cause I was really into IPAs back when I was younger and lived in Washington. And then I moved away and then it was gone for a decade. So it's probably the first time I ever actually bought bottles of Pliny the Elder in Washington State. So that was pretty cool. Cause I've always loved this beer. Like whenever I visit California or Oregon, fun fact, the states that Russian River distributes to are now Washington again, California, Oregon, Colorado. And Jeff, what do you think the fifth state, primarily a city, that they distribute to?
Austin.
No.
Texas. No.
It actually is very relevant to what we were just talking about.
Vermont?
Still no. Vermont? No.
Okay. Because we were talking about Heady, and I was like...
No. Philadelphia. Philadelphia.
Oh, there we go.
Distributes to Philadelphia.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so like so if you're in Philadelphia watching the Cougs, you can get Pliny the Elder there.
Get yourself some Pliny.
Get yourself some Pliny. Get yourself some Blind Pig. Get yourself some Consecration. Whatever. Go to Monk's Cafe, I want to say it's called. They're like Russian River's favorite bar. So they would be the most likely to have Russian River there. If you are traveling to Philadelphia and you want to have one of the best West Coast IPAs of all time. Yes. So yeah, we're drinking Pliny, just classic beer. Very excited to have it back in Washington. And, you know, but also very strong beer, to help drown some of our sorrows of the men's basketball team's kind of agonizing, but had turned into fun, season towards the end, finally coming to an end in the most fitting of fashion without their best player who was out because of injury. So, of course the men lost to, Eastern Washington, which is, doubly annoying, in Pullman on the last night, which would have been Tuesday night, as we're recording this. So just a, you know, pretty frustrating game. Like you said, Eastern was trying to exploit the fact that we just had no big men. Obviously, they weren't going to play Jack a lot. Andrame is still battling back from a hand injury. He wasn't going to play a lot. So they went small most of this game. And for a long time, Eastern just tried to force it inside and was turning the ball over a lot. I think they were better off when they were going inside with their wings and guards, because there was just no rim protector. And that once they figured that out, that they were doing better. But, you know, WSU fell behind in the first half, and then, of course, came back and was up by 9. With what'd you say the win percentage was at that point?
Oh God. 95%. It was a little over 95%.
So what the fuck happened?
Well, if you listen to Kyle Smith tell it, they ran around like chickens with their heads cut off. That's how he said it. It's like,
yeah,
we started dorking around and didn't do what we should have done. And, you know, like,
yeah, you really saw like
fucking up
when they came back, you know, at the start of the game, they were letting Eastern get some open looks. Then they came back and they built this solid lead. And then all Eastern erased that lead like really quickly.
Yep.
And then it was kind of a close game down the stretch. And then they just, it was just a few fuck ups down the stretch again.
Yep.
End of game again. End of game. TJ dribbles the ball off his foot.
Which, by the way, he was fucking fouled on that play.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He dribbled the ball off his foot because the dude, like, kneed him in the thigh and knocked his foot over. He got under his leg, and that's why he dribbled it off his foot. But, you know, whatever.
TJ needs to learn to sell contact better.
Yes. And I am going to say, by the way, overall, I think it was a pretty good officiating game. Like, I don't. You know, we complain about officials sometimes. I think overall it was an okay officiated game, but yeah, super annoying down the stretch. You know, the two plays, I guess there's like, you know, the three play sequence that, you know, makes you just want to like go run through a window or something. Like, you know, you give up the wide open three, Eastern takes, Venters takes to go up by 3 points. And you know, DJ Rodman was just, you know, lost on defense for whatever reason. And so he ends up scrambling and can't even come close. And, you know, and honestly, it may not have mattered. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. Like, you know, it's not like Venters didn't hit threes with dudes like right in his grill anyway. The dude's 6'7". He just shoots over everybody. So, you know, whatever. And then you come back down the other end and you work for a wide open three for Andre, and then he misses. And so then you foul and Venters comes down and misses the free throw, and the four guys that are in the lane are somehow completely asleep, and Venters gets his own rebound, and you know, you're just like, okay, you know, whatever. Inexcusable. I mean, like, that's, and I don't use that word very often. I try to avoid that word because, you know, there's just, they're college guys, like, they're gonna make mistakes, stuff's gonna happen, but that's a 0 out of 100 type of play. Like, that should never happen. Either
TJ or Justin just needs to step in front of him.
Anybody who's played basketball knows on a free throw, literally one of the first thing you do is who has the shooter. Like, that's it. Like, it should be like automatic, you know, like you've probably been doing it since you were in fifth grade, right? Like, who's got the shooter? And I guess they didn't talk or whatever. And, you know, after he got the rebound, they all stared at each other like, I thought you had him, you know. And it just, you know, it was maddening. And I understand why it leaves kind of a sour taste in people's mouths, you know,
especially Coach Smith.
Oh my God. Like, he's normally, I guess I wouldn't characterize him as, you know, Mr. Positivity necessarily, but he's also like, well, you know, we're going to work on that, and you know, we're going to get better. And, you know, I mean, he's just kind of like, you know, we're just going to, you know, keep it moving. I think he was pretty pissed off that this was the way the season ended. And then I also think, like, and maybe get your thoughts on this, see what you think about this idea. You know, he kind of lit him up on the radio after the game, you know, and he was just, you know, extremely mad, you know, said they played dumb and they, you know, they got to fix it. And we are going to fix it. We're going to fix that for next year. That's never going to happen again. And not only, I think, was it notable because he generally doesn't say stuff like that, but I think just kind of coaches in general don't say stuff like that anymore. In an environment where players can leave anytime they want, right? Like, so I think, you know, coaches kind of walk this line of, you know, coaching guys hard, but also, you know, not so hard that you piss them off and they leave. And, you know, back when players really didn't have any choices, there were a lot of coaches that were really famous for just being assholes. You know, obviously, you know, Bobby Knight's kind of the biggest example, right? Like he just, I mean, he quite literally abused his players and got away with it for, you know, three decades because, you know, where the hell are you going to go, buddy? You're stuck with me. You've picked it. You're here. You're stuck. If you want to transfer, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that you don't land in a good spot. And then you're going to have to sit out a year and you're going to lose a year of eligibility. And, you know, it just was, players were kind of stuck. And so coaches, I think, had, you know, carte blanche to, you know, coach guys really, really hard, sometimes maybe even bordering on abuse, right? And so you just don't hear that much anymore. So to hear that out of Smith's mouth makes me wonder, like, okay, you know, it just, it sounded to me, I didn't actually hear the audio, but just reading the quote, it sounds to me almost like a tone setter for the offseason. Like, okay, boys, you know, you want to take the next step, you want to do the next thing, this shit's got to stop. And we're not fucking around anymore. Like, it's going to stop right now, and it stops today. And everything we do going forward will be to stop that. If you want to be good, then this shit's going to end, and we're going to get there, but you got to stop this now, and I am fucking serious. And it's like, that to me indicates perhaps that he feels pretty confident about his roster, you know, feels pretty confident that the guys that he was, you know, reading the riot act after the game are, I mean, look, if half your team's leaving, what's the point of doing that? Right? Like,
right.
You know, if you know half your team's leaving, what's the point? Like, there's no point in that other than, you know, I get, maybe you're just angry and you feel better. Like, I don't know. I mean, I do that sometimes, but you know, if you're a coach and you're pretty calculated, and Kyle Smith seems to be pretty calculated and a really good coach, like there's no point to, you know, lay in the wood and then, you know, six of those guys aren't going to be on the team next year, you know? So I kind of wonder if it's not maybe an indicator that the vast majority of the team is going to be back. Would you maybe read it that way? Do you think I'm off base?
No, I don't think you're off base. I also, you know, I get the sense, just for beat around the team, is like there's a feeling that most of them will come back. You know, I mean, obviously DJ is coming back. I see no reason why Yaki is going to leave. TJ seems really into the program. I think people will maybe try to, you know, he'll get some looks, maybe some tampering.
He'll get some phone calls.
but I think he's in a good place here. I think he likes his role and, he likes it here. You know, and he's really improved at WSU. I think he sees value in that. You know, Justin Powell has often been an iffy one because he's transferred so much, but I also get the sense that, you know, he's got a good role here. Like he's a starter. He's going to play. He's going to, you know, if he wanted to be more aggressive, he could be. Like I think he definitely had more carte blanche to do things this year than he actually did, that he actually like output. But they gave him every opportunity, like an opportunity he's never gotten before. Other than like six game, you know, not, he didn't even play that much at Auburn. So his opportunities never gotten before. So I think there's a feeling that he's pretty solid. You know, Mo is iffy one, but we've talked about him before. Mo is probably NBA or WSU. Because if Mo wanted to leave, he could have left last year. If he wanted to leave to another program, he could have done that last year. And then after that, they gave him the reins to the offense, basically. So why, you know, if he's going to go, what other program's going to give him that? Give him the opportunity to develop the skills that he's going to need in the NBA, like the facilitator skills, the wing skills, you know? So Mo, it, you know, that's like a 50-50 thing, I think. We're going to see what he gets on, you know, what the NBA thinks of him. Obviously, that's going to be a challenge for him if he's injured right now. And I think Kyle mentioned that it's a potentially 6-week issue, which is, you know, a time when he potentially could be evaluated, up until the deadline to declare for the draft. But, you know, or after that, if he's not healthy by then. So it's so and then you go down the list more. You know, there's you know, guy like this. I don't think Jabe's going anywhere. And after that, there's a lot of guys that didn't play very much. I don't think Dylan's going anywhere. You know, Carlos, I could potentially see leaving. Probably he's probably the strongest.
He's really the only one that kind of fits the classic profile, right? Like a guy who's, you know, ostensibly fairly talented, not playing a lot of minutes, and you don't really see a way forward to more minutes, right? Like you look at the roster and you go, okay, you know, where's he going to play? Right, he plays the same position as DJ. He plays the same position as Andre. Like those two guys are gonna play, you know, 20 to 30 minutes each. You know, and then next year you're moving in. You know, Chinyelu's coming. You figure Zhang's a year older. Like, okay, so you're even if Mo's not back, you know, you're still, you know, perhaps
they're in the wild card JUCO transfer here.
Yeah, Oscar Clough, right, who seems like maybe a bench player, but, you know, I mean, who knows? I mean, when Terrell Roberts showed up, we were like, oh, yeah, he's probably going to come off the bench and be a sixth man, and then he, you know, plays 35 minutes a night. So, you know, whatever. I just think, like, minutes in the front court slash, you know, the sort of the 3-4 area where he is are just going to be awfully crowded. So, obviously, I think he's the one that sort of classically fits the profile. I just don't think, like, I think the roster is set up really nicely where you've got guys who are established in their roles, but you've also got guys who are developing and could be in line for more minutes, which, you know, you might be like oh, Kamani. No, you know, they might be in line for more minutes. But also you look at, like, man, you know, do we really want Justin Powell playing 35 minutes a game again next year? I sure don't. And not because he's not good enough, but, like, I don't want anybody
just too much.
35 minutes a game. It's just too much. You know, and, like, I mean, I wrote about this, you know, in the newsletter this morning. Like, man, I mean, I want to hate on that free throw box out, but also, like, I mean, three of the guys in that lane played 37 or were in, like, their 37th or 38th minute in that game. You know, and every coach knows, you know, the phenomenon of, you know, tired body, tired mind. Right, you know, your body's tired, your mind gets tired, and then you have a brain fart, right? So, you know, I don't want anybody playing those kind of minutes again. You know, I want TJ playing 32 minutes. I want Justin Powell playing 32 minutes. I want Mo playing 32 minutes. Like, that's what I want. And so, if that happens, great. You know, now you've got, you know, Zhang maybe playing, you know, 15 minutes a game instead of, you know, six, right? You know. Or if Deshaun comes back, you know, again, you've got him playing, you know, 20 minutes a game. Chinyelu, maybe 20 minutes a game. You're not counting on your freshmen, you know, to come in and be, you know, major contributors. You know, Darling maybe pumps up to, like, you know, 10 minutes a game. Like, you start to see, you know, Jabe is maybe a 20 to 25 minute guy instead of, I guess that's kind of what he was most of the season. But, you know, you don't, like, I want him to stay in that kind of a role, right? Because he's a bit of a defensive liability, but he's such a weapon, you know, when he's hitting threes. So,
well, you really
want the rosters.
You want to be able to take him off the court if he's not hitting shots and he's
yes, you want to do that. So, I just kind of look at the roster and I go, you know, there's not a situation where you see players who feel like they ought to be playing more, so they're going to be unhappy, or, you know, guys who feel like they should have more usage or whatever. I just think that it sets up kind of nicely for a bunch of guys to be fairly content with their roles and just sort of see, you know, a path forward. The big thing is, you know, as we've kind of talked about, Deshaun and Miles Rice, like, you know, do they even come back? We know Miles finished his cancer treatment. I mean, I do have some experience, obviously. I have a child, had a child who had cancer, he's still alive. But it's like, you know, he went through cancer treatment and I've seen, you know, what can happen there. You know, leukemia is a little different. The treatment is much, much longer, you know, so the chemo has a much more pronounced effect on the body. But, you know, I mean, Miles at this point has been, I mean, I don't know, 6 months, right, of I think, chemo treatment. You know, that does stuff. Neuropathy is a real concern. You know, so maybe he's not the player that he once was, but I also, I would be surprised if there were any just like out and out restrictions on him. So I'm assuming he's going to be back. Deshaun, you know, who knows? You know, whatever happened with him, you know, seemed pretty serious. You know, so we'll see, you know, kind of what happens there. I know he's hopeful to play again, but, you know, things have been very quiet, which to me, I don't know, feels a little curious. Like with Miles, it's sort of been this foregone conclusion. Okay, you know, he's going to go through treatment, he's going to be fine, and he's going to come back, and you know, he's going to give it a go, and I'm sure the team will give him every opportunity to play. Like things have just been so quiet with Deshaun, and about the only time we hear about anything is when he, you know, posts to Instagram himself. So I don't know, a little bit of maybe mystery there. And then, you know, and always somebody leaves who's a total surprise. If I were to pick someone who would be a total surprise, it'd probably be Andre. Just because, yeah, you know, European guys can just sort of up and decide, okay, I'm done, you know, going to Europe. And, you know, I'd rather go play in a, you know, a second division league somewhere in Europe than play college anymore. So that would be my pick. I don't know. Do you have a pick for a guy who might be a total, like, you know, a bit of a stunner of a transfer?
Yeah. You know, I could see someone, you know, I would go the international route and be like, you know, like Kamani, like, you know, just to,
yeah, that might
know,
be one.
Yeah. Maybe he can play some pro ball somewhere or something. That, you know, that's, that'd be the only one. But I think they'll probably instill in Kamani that he has a pretty good opportunity here if he stays to get quite a bit of playing time. Because, you know, they tried to use him as much as they could this year, but he got kind of progressively worse as the season went on. So it was hard to have him in all the time, you know. So, it, you know, if he develops his three-point shot a little better, he becomes like a completely different player.
That's a big project, man.
Yeah, it's not a pretty looking jump.
I'm not sure. I mean, there are some guys where I go, yeah, you know, I can kind of, like, I feel like with Gay, you know, I see that. I go, yeah, you know, like that's something he could add to his game next year for sure. Like I kind of just need a little more consistency. You know, the release needs to be consistent. The footwork needs to be good. But like, you know, you can see with Kamani, it's like, I mean, he was shooting free throws last night and I'm like, oh my God, like that is, you know, he brings the ball all the way over his head.
It's like all the way over his head. Shoots. Yeah,
it's so hard to watch. So I don't know, man. Need to get that guy hooked up with you know, with the former Coug, right?
Chris Matthews,
Lethal Shooter. Chris Matthews. Need to get him hooked up with Lethal Shooter, man. That's what we need.
Absolutely. Yeah, come on, Chris. We need to get you in on Kamani and on Mo if he's coming back, or even if he's not, help him out. And Dylan Darling, please.
Yeah, that one too.
Talk about
that
a guy
one,
who
I feel like just needs a little more confidence. Like he just, you know, he's just kind of lost.
He has quite the wind up to his shot. He needs to shorten
that
it
is
up
true.
A bit.
That is true.
Like, yeah, he's got, good. Yeah. But he's, yeah, that's a dude, like, he can just make, like, obviously you think of the women's team, like with Tara Wallach last year, I was just like, if she could just make shots, like, she'd be, like, so good. Like, I know it's dumb, but, like, she looks, she's doing things well. It's just the shots aren't falling. That's the same for Dylan, you know. Obviously, he's he's not as quite as, like, gifted with size that Tara has. But, like, you know, this year, like, he's a very good on-ball defender. If he could just make threes once in a while, it'd be nice, you know.
Little bit of a concern is that his numbers are so bad.
Like, they're so bad.
You know, typically when someone is that bad, it's real tough to rebound and come back. And like, I mean, I know from talking with the coaching staff, not about Darling in particular, just about like player stats and when they evaluate guys and they're kind of looking at, you know, what guys have done. And, I know that they look at things like, you know, their offensive rating or whatever. And then they, like, how often does a guy actually, like, significantly improve from that? And Darling is definitely down in that area where you go, okay, that's, like that is, like, major red flag.
But
so, I don't know. We'll see.
I guarantee in the back of Kyle's head, he's like, maybe he's my next Frankie Ferrari.
Maybe he's Frankie Ferrari, yeah.
Because Frankie Ferrari, if you look at his freshman year, Yep. Right around this.
So bad.
Right in the 70s O rating. Yep. But the one good thing about Dylan is he didn't take very many shots. So it's like a pretty small sample size. Like he took 51 shots the entire year. Of course, there was certain games where he took like 5 threes. Like it's like
yes. The teams were like, please shoot a three. And he's like, okay, I guess I have to. Yeah. No, I'm not down on him actually.
It's his free throw.
I think athletically he's good enough. So
yeah, his free throw shooting does it that is, that's like, that gives you some hope because like his free throw stroke is solid. He hits 75%.
And he strikes me as a guy who once he kind of figures things out can draw contact and get free throws. Like he's got that kind of, he's very springy. He's not very tall. I know he's listed at 6'2". I think he's probably 6 feet. Six foot and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
But he's very springy and he's got a good first step and I think he's going to figure out how to draw contact and hang in the air. I think he is going to figure that out. And I think that's going to be a real strength of his is getting in the lane and drawing contact. So yeah, I think he can be a real weapon that way. He's going to have to shoot it. I know he shot it in high school. So, you know, maybe it's just a matter of, like you said, shortening that up. Getting a little more confidence, but yeah, I still have high hopes for him. I think he's going to be okay, and I think you need guys like that in the program. You know, I don't know that he's not ready. I don't think he's going to be ready to kind of take over the point and you know be the lead guy next year or anything. But you know, 2 years from now, you can definitely see that. Like, I think you get guys like that, you keep them around, you develop them. You know, DJ Rodman types. I know they play obviously totally different positions, but you know, like. When you think about the career arc, you know, it's the kind of guy you think of. You need guys like that in your program. So, well, yeah. And, I'm glad to have him. I think he'll be fine.
Well, and the thing with, you know, when you look at Dylan, I look at Dylan, Kamani, and Andrame, just the three of them, it is very typical for guys as they go into their second year to reduce their turnover rates considerably.
Yep.
And we saw
TJ
it with like
a lot of
TJ, we saw it with Noah, like it, so, like, so we saw it with Andre too. Yeah, Kamani 28, Andrame 36%, Dylan 28%. Those are all terrible numbers. They're all pretty standard for freshmen though. Pretty standard. Like freshmen have really high turnover rates very commonly. And we see them dip. Like TJ's is 14.7 this year, and he was handling the ball so much more than he's ever done before. And he had a 14.7 turnover rate. That is a very really low turnover rate, by the way, by a guy with his the amount of time, how much he dribble drives. Like that's a very very good turnover rate. You just have high like those guys are going to improve their offensive ratings if they just don't fucking give the ball away as much. Like, and I have every confidence with this coaching staff that they will ensure that they do not give the ball away as much. So when you get a guy like Powell, a guy like TJ now, that just don't turn the ball over very much at all. You know, that's a good sign. I don't know if we're not really looking ahead, but it's hard not to. But if we're like, I don't know, maybe we could run through this season, you know, kind of give the evaluation of the season another time. But man, they played most of the season. They played the entire season down two scholarship players. They played almost the entire conference schedule down three scholarship players after Mael left, and they went 11-9 in conference play, which is. Not many WSU teams go over 500 in conference play. The season
first time back to back over 500 since Tony Bennett.
Yep. The season ended with a bad taste in our mouth, of course, but you know, like they were dealt like the worst hand all year and just dealt one more bad hand at the end and they couldn't overcome it. And you know, we've talked about it a lot, but the season looks a lot different. If Miles and Deshaun are there, like it's just, and you know, Mael doesn't like, he doesn't even play if Deshaun's there. Like, and then Mael became a player that was actually contributing and then he left. Like, you know, it was.
Yep.
And then we're down to playing, you know, Jack Wilson minutes at the end of the year because we just have no more bigs left. Like, we had one scholarship. We had one healthy scholarship big for that entire seven-game win streak because Andrame was not playing. And even when he did, it was like for a couple minutes maybe. So that's why we saw Jack get some minutes. And so we had one scholarship big. We had, you know, for a significant chunk of the season. Then you have, you're out of scholarship guard. It's just the crap they went through this year that we're sitting there. We're bitching about an NIT loss even is like pretty remarkable. They're going to finish, you know, they're around 63 in KenPop right now. Who knows where that will end up, but it'll end up around there, probably, barring another miracle Pac-12 run in the NCAA tournament. Yeah, it's just it was a frustrating season, but I don't know. Like, I feel pretty good about them keeping a lot of parts of this roster together going forward. And I know that they're feeling like, if they could just have a little bit of good luck for once, like, this could be an NCAA tournament team next year. And they don't feel like they need to add a super superlative piece. Like, they feel like they could, with what they got, is like right there. As long as they just aren't just getting the worst fucking luck in the world.
And I think people also, like, I've seen this floating around. So obviously a lot of people really mad about losing to Eastern, and I don't know, this weird stuff pops up that, like, you know, Kyle Smith doesn't develop players or something. Like, I'm just like, what? Like, where does this even come from? But, you know, people I think are afraid, like, oh man, you know, man, we're going to lose Mo, and then where are we at? We're just back to square one. And I'm like, no, like, I don't think that's true at all. Like, now, are they better with Mo? Obviously, we want to keep Mo. If Mo comes back for one more year, I mean, next year could be a really special season. So, like, okay. But if Mo leaves, like, I mean, you still have this incredible, like, amount of talent. Like, you know, assuming that, you know, virtually every other, you know, contributor stays. Like, okay, in the front court, you're talking, you know, probably Zhang, Chinyelu, Clough, right? And maybe Deshaun, right? We don't know if Deshaun's coming back. But, you know, you got, you know, solid talent there, but the perimeter is where you're really, really, really strong still. You know, you're dealing with, you know, you got Powell, you got Bamba, you got Andre, you got DJ, you got Jabe. Like you saw what those guys can do just last night, right? Like, in the second half, you know, where they led the team all the way back and they're just burying threes from all over the floor. Like, and then you add in potentially Miles, or, you know, if Miles decides he can't go anymore, then, you know, maybe a transfer. But it's like, man, there is still a ton of talent. And when you factor in all those guys continuing to improve, you know, and this idea that players don't improve under Kyle Smith is absolutely insane. Like, I don't know any other way to say it. Like, it's really, there's no evidence to support that idea. About the only player, like, I threw this out on Twitter because I'm like, where does this come from? What are people looking at when they say this? Like, I'm like genuinely curious. Nobody could come up with anything other than the team wasn't as good this year as I thought they should be, which, okay, right? But, you know, they projected that onto this, you know, development, I guess, or something. I think the only guy that you could say, has he really gotten that much better? Honestly, is kind of Andre. Because, you know, if you look at, and I'm not saying that's true, I'm just saying, like, if you look at, like, his stat profile, has he gotten that much better? Last year, this year.
He's a lot better than he was as a freshman.
Sure. But, like, last year, this year, maybe not. But also, like, the guy had a fucking, you know, turf toe for 6 months and, you know, has been dealing with other issues and he got his fucking tooth knocked out in the Pac-12. I mean, just, like, the dude is, like, the most unlucky guy with injuries, and that stuff affects you, you know, like, it really affects you. So I guess
it's like literal development time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you want to be like, Andre's not as good as he should be, okay, fine, But is TJ, you know, how much is TJ improved? How much is Mo improved? How much is, you know, any other guy on the roster improved? Like, it's just, it's silly. It's absolutely silly. So
DJ,
what I'm saying is, yeah, DJ, you know, it's like, okay, if we can, I mean, I don't know how many guys have sort of topped out. I suspect that DJ probably isn't going to give you a whole lot more than what he's already given. You know, maybe he can get a tick better shooting. You know, maybe he can get a tick better passing, by something. But it's like, you're probably a little bit maxed out there, but I don't think TJ is maxed out. Like, I can point to things that he can do better. He can be a better ball handler. He can be a better passer. Like, he can work the pick and roll better. If he can become a real good pick and roll guy, I mean, like, honestly, he could become like a James Harden type. Not that I think he's as good as James Harden, but it's like, you know, that kind
of... Well, he could definitely get better at drawing and selling contact.
Yeah, drawing and selling contact. Like, which is a thing that James Harden does, right? Like, if he can work on those hesitation moves and, you know, sort of his craft running that pick and roll, he can get even better. Justin Powell can just be, I don't know, maybe like, you know, 20% more aggressive. Like, that would be great. You know, Jabe.
Which we know he can be from his Auburn time. Like, we know he has that in him.
We know he's got it in him. So, you know, Jabe can be a better defender. You know, obviously Adrame has, you know, huge, you know, areas where he can grow. Like, he just, and Darling, and Kamani. Kamani's like, yo, if he takes the normal freshman to sophomore jump, people are going to freak out about how good he is. Like, you figure all these guys are going to get better. Even if you lose Mo, the team is still going to be really damn good. And it bums me out that people kind of, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater on some of this stuff, where it's like, well, you know, they pissed me off on this thing, and, you know, now Mo's going to leave, and... It's like, well, much here to be excited about.
But if you don't, like, if you look at what they lost from last year to this year.
Yes.
And still are a top 60, they're 63 on KenPom. Like, that required improvement from a lot of guys. Because they lost, on top of all the players they lost, like, all, like, the key, like, I think it was, like, 6 of 7 top usage players, something like that. They also lost Deshaun before the season started. And so that's another guy that they relied on the year before. And so you had to have improvement from TJ and Mo, like they did.
Yep.
Like, and they both shot up their usage dramatically and still were either as efficient or more efficient. And just, you can watch both of them. And the things they can do that they could not do last year, or TJ, the TJ Bamba of his freshman year, where he was always 100 miles an hour. Like, now this guy that has these hesitation moves and can ride with someone on his hip and hit a little floater in the lane. Like, it's, and hits, you know, hits jumpers off the dribble. Like, it's crazy, you know? Like, he has a quicker release. Like, He and Mo, like, the reason they even were able to go 11-9 this year is because TJ jumped and Mo jumped, and then they went and found Powell, who wasn't a point guard, but they had to have someone. But he shot threes really well, and they went and found Jabe, who filled in, you know, got him some wins here and there, and you know, they kind of threw together this, like, team after all these losses that was still, like, better than, like, 90% of WSU teams ever. So, like, all the bad luck, all the losses, all the turnover, and just to still the team that they threw together this year and the improvement we saw from the guys, it's not a, you know, this isn't a season that we're gonna, you know, toast to and yay, a great season, but I think it is a season to prove that this program, like, the bottom is so much higher than it ever, like, than it rarely has ever been.
It's like, kind of like proof of concept, right? Like, like, okay, you know, all this shit went wrong and went badly, and you had enough talent to still put together a winning record, still make the NIT, which is not a given, you know, for this program, still have a winning record in the Pac-12. I am begging people to imagine an Ernie Kent team when Robert Franks was on the team and Robert Franks getting hurt and what that team would have looked like. Like, I just, Folks, you got to keep it in perspective. It's Brian Anderson's number one rule. Know thyself, right? Like, look at your history, look at the program, and don't focus on, I was promised an NCAA tournament. Focus on, like, man, this team, like, did pretty damn good and provided us with some pretty damn entertaining moments. You know, beat Arizona, swept Washington, like a few other things as well. You know, did they have some downs? Of course. But on balance, pretty entertaining. On balance, pretty interesting. And, you know, that's with facing a pretty inordinate amount of challenges.
Yeah. So I guess we did rehash the season.
I guess we did. We can do more another time.
We can do. Oh, I'm sure we'll have. Sure, we'll have our favorite podcast guest on in the off season. But I think he's got some busy times coming up with the portal and recruiting and all that. But yeah. I guess like we could transition here now is to talk about a program that really, you know, another coach that seems like he's been doing the right stuff, just hasn't quite got the results yet. But maybe this is the season that pays off, because the baseball team is off to a hell of a fucking start. I think they lost.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, you lose sometimes in baseball. Like, you play so many games. You know, before that, start 13-2, and they won a series in Corvallis for the first time since 2009, and then got ranked for the first time since 2010. Now, what's the significance of that time in Cougar baseball? That was Donnie Marbitt's, you know, best time in Cougar baseball, you know, or leading up to it. That's the last time this program was good. And so maybe this is a squad that, you know, they've already set, they have a good base set for a potential run to a postseason. And that's exciting, because it's really fun when the baseball team is pushing towards a postseason. You know, there's nothing quite like a postseason run in baseball, even in college baseball. The way the college baseball tournament is set up is pretty exciting, like pretty exciting to watch. Yep. So it's really fun. But obviously losing today to San Francisco, not great,
they won a series against Oregon State on the road.
And then they got ranked number 20. So like all good stuff.
Midweek games are just whatever.
Yeah. Midweek games often go very strange ways. To start conference play by taking 2 out of 3 at Corvallis is pretty awesome. And I think it shows that this team is pretty damn good. You know, you don't win 13 out of 15 without being pretty damn good. I think it could be fun, Jeff. I think we're probably going to dedicate more time to the baseball team.
Yeah.
This year.
And it's been a long time too. Like that was like one of the original like Coug Center things. Like we had a hell of a lot of fun following those Donnie Marbitt teams. I distinctly remember that, you know, regional in Arkansas, right? Like it's really fun. It's really, really fun. College baseball can be a hell of a lot of fun when it's going well. So. Yeah, looking forward to getting to know this team. I'm gonna be honest. I've been like, they're winning. That's great. I don't know anybody who's on the team, so we'll get there.
They have a nice stretch to test themselves coming up. Oregon for 3 at home, Gonzaga on the road in a midweek game, and then they travel down to Los Angeles to face USC for 3. So that'll be a nice stretch to. Like, test where you're at, really. Obviously, they did very well in obviously, in baseball, you continue to play non-conference games throughout the season because you have those midweek games. But through the core of the non-conference, they did very well. And now they're in conference play. Now's really here. They got to prove themselves, and it'll be exciting to watch. Yeah, and they're scoring runs. It seems like that's their strength so far is the bats, and then the pitching kind of depends. So I think as the season goes on,
that's what we thought we were getting with Green, right?
Yeah,
like that's what we hired him for. You know, he developed bats when he was at New Mexico State. So
yeah, so you know, as the season goes on, at basketball ends, you know, devote more time to getting to know the baseball team more. So, but hopefully, we will be doing that as they are making a postseason push. So follow that. Anything else to talk about? Am I missing anything big? Charlize, of course, was named honorable mention All-American. She's the player of the year in my heart.
Yes.
But even though I know Caitlin Clark exists, it's fine. But yeah, honorable mention All-American, which is pretty awesome. I think potentially the first since WC has had, I think since the 90s, any sort of All-American pick. So that's pretty cool. And then Cammy Etheridge, The Athletic named her National Coach of the Year, which Woo. Is pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome.
So yeah, very exciting. Those two, of course, have a very big game on Saturday. That's what we're focused on. That's what we're excited about. Yeah, Jeff, I guess the big thing that we're pushing now is that Substack. How can people get hooked up with that Substack? You're fucking writing like a madman. Like, you've been writing so much content for that.
I'm having fun writing again, man. Podcast dseveryone.substack.com. Sign up for the newsletter, and the podcast appears there as well as anything else that I write. Basically, my writing lives there now. I'm not doing too much for Coop Center anymore. So if you want to read the stuff that I write, and maybe, just maybe, I can coax Craig into doing a little writing at some point. And we'll go with that. So yeah, sign up for the Substack. Get yourself on in there. Share it with a friend. You know, get them to sign up as well. And then also, by the way, the Substack has a nice little app too, which is nice. I actually really like using the app on my my iPad to read all the different Substack newsletters that I subscribe to. So yeah, be sure and sign up on that.
Awesome. Yes, do that. That's the most important thing. That's all that matters. Substack. Yeah. So, Jeff, I guess, you know, got a goddamn NCAA tournament game coming up on Saturday. So, it's what I'll need to say is go fucking Cougs.
Go fucking Cougs, Craig. Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter.
Get vaccinated.
Keep it up.
Support your local.
I like having days off. It's-